From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, how about some good news for a change? At a time when a narrow version of political conservative Christianity dominates our public rhetoric and public policy, four members of the U.S. House of Representatives have formed the Freethinker Caucus. Objectives? Number one, to promote public policy formed on the basis of reason, science, and moral values. Number two, to protect the secular character of our government by adhering to the strict constitutional principle of the separation of church and state. Number three, to oppose discrimination against atheists, agnostics, humanists, seekers, religious and non-religious persons, and to champion the value of freedom of thought and conscience worldwide. And number four, to provide a forum for members of Congress to discuss their moral frameworks, ethical values, and personal religious journeys, to all of which I can only say amen. President Donald Trump proclaimed May as Jewish Heritage Month. In his statement issued by the White House on Monday, Trump said that Jewish Americans have helped guide the moral character of our nation. And around the world, restrictions on reproductive rights are directly linked to limits on women's access to education and economic independence. That's why it is so disturbing that the United States State Department has quietly scrubbed reproductive rights as a category from its annual human rights report. Predictably, the move is being celebrated by American anti-abortion religious conservatives who, notably, never have to personally pay the kind of price that third world women do for their dogmatic ideology, which should have no place in U.S. secular foreign policy anyway. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
ALEC is a nationwide consortium of elected state legislators working side by side with some of America's most powerful corporations. ALEC says close to 1,000 bills, based at least in part on its models, are introduced every year, and an average of 200 passed.
The American Legislative Exchange Council has been devastatingly effective at developing the most effective language for extremist, pro-business, anti-people laws, and then getting those laws passed in dozens of states. Seeing that effectiveness has inspired culture warriors to give the technique a try, in service to their regressive theocratic agenda. Shockingly, they call it Project Blitz. And researcher Fred Clarkson will be with us to share some of the revelations in his recent report titled Project Blitz Seeks to Do for Christian Nationalism What ALEC Does for Big Business.
We're stunned, we're shocked at the judgments that seemingly are being made about our lives.
One of those judgments is that nuns are flirting with radical feminism. The Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, headed by American Cardinal William Levada, accused them of not doing enough to promote Catholic doctrine on human sexuality.
It may seem like another lifetime, but it was 6 years ago that American Catholic women religious were sanctioned by a Vatican commission for stepping out of line. What came next was a new pope. But the targets of the commission weren't out of the woods. A new book tells the searing story of that spiritually and politically challenging ordeal, and I'll talk to one of the contributors, Sister Sharon Holland. But first,
a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
It's the third year that the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding published its substantive American Muslim poll, which for 2018 is subtitled Pride and Prejudice. There's a wealth of data in this poll, as always, revealing the effect our national climate is having on Muslims and non-Muslims alike. For details, I'm pleased to be joined by co-author Yusuf Shahood. Yusuf, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
New in this year's report is the Islamophobia Index. Now, this is jarring.
One of the characteristics of our current political moment is this ramping up of anti-Muslim animus. And so we wanted to really nail that down, try to measure it as best we could, and also provide something of a gauge that can be referred back to and kind of see trends as they go along from year to year. We asked respondents to the poll, and I should note that we have respondents from the general public. We also have an oversample of Jewish respondents and an oversample of Muslim respondents as well. So this is a really unique and quite rare cross-group comparison that we're able to provide with this poll. And so we asked each of the respondents a set of five different questions that are drawn from the general stereotypes, the general negative stereotypes that people associate with Muslims. That they're prone to violence, that they discriminate against women, whether they're hostile to the United States, that they're generally less civilized than others, and you know that they have a group responsibility for the violence that's carried out by members of their community. So for each one of these questions, we asked whether they strongly agree or strongly disagree on a five-point scale. And we were able to kind of take those five items and create an index from 0 to 100 that you can easily compare between groups. And yeah, some of the findings are indeed jarring. For example, 1 in 5 Muslims believe that Muslims are more prone to violence. So, you know, one of the things that really came out of this index is this notion of kind of internalized Islamophobia is very real. And the index itself ranges from the lowest is actually the non-affiliated among the general public at 14 on that 0 to 100 scale. And the highest goes all the way up to the white evangelical subgroup that we were able to kind of take out of that general public sample, where they go all the way up to 40 on that scale. Hmm.
The report links ranking on the index to support for anti-Muslim policies and a tendency toward authoritarianism. Explain that, if you will.
Not surprising if you have these negative attitudes towards Muslims, if you rank higher on this scale, whether or not you're in the general public or among our Muslim sample, you're more prone to support anti-Muslim policies. That seems, you know, pretty intuitive. What was perhaps not necessarily something that we would take for granted is that those who rank higher on the Islamophobia Index also tend to support authoritarian policies. And the way that we conceptualize that is through two questions asking, you know, in the wake of a hypothetical terrorist incident in this country, would you support the suspension of checks and balances in order to kind of deal with that threat? So that's one question. And then the second question was similarly, you know, given this scenario in the wake of a terrorist incident, would you support kind of limits on press freedom challenging those in authority? And so this tendency to give deference to authority and kind of preference for social order to the detriment of certain freedoms, and particularly certain freedoms that accrue to minority populations. And so those who scored higher on the Islamophobia Index were more likely to support these two measures of authoritarianism in our survey.
I'm curious about the findings on Muslim Americans and how they compare to other groups in rejecting violence.
One of the key negative stereotypes that folks associate with Muslims generally, and perhaps American Muslims as well, is that they're likelier to support violence in support of their cause. We asked two questions, and the way that we phrased the questions actually tapped into two particular kinds of violence. First question asked whether a military should target and kill civilians, whether that's sometimes justified or whether it's always unjustified. And this is kind of the textbook example of a war crime, right? If you target and kill civilians, that's pretty much the definition of a war crime, you know, under anybody's definition. And then similarly, we asked whether killing and targeting civilians, not by a military, but by a small group or an individual, if that's sometimes justified or if that's, you know, always unjustified. And that's one of the key characteristics of terrorism. So we have, you know, kind of war crimes on the one hand, terrorism on the other hand. And on both these measures, Muslims were just as likely, if not more likely, to flat out reject those two modes of violence than anybody else in our sample. This includes, you know, the various subgroups within the general public, as well as, you know, the Jewish oversample that we had. So to give you a couple of specifics, 71% of Muslims outright rejected the targeting of civilians by military. That's perhaps, you know, a bit more expected, that they would be much higher on that scale, given that there's this understanding among many Muslims that they are on the receiving end of a lot of that violence. But even when it comes to terrorism, which, by the way, Muslims are also very much on the receiving end of terrorism far more than anybody else. Similarly, they have 80%, so 8 out of 10 Muslims outright reject, say there is, it is never justified that a small group kind of targets civilians when it comes to this mode of violence, this mode of terrorism. And this is, you know, kind of on par with the Jewish oversample and the non-affiliated. And then other groups have a more middling take when it comes to these two issues.
Did anything in this research surprise you?
Yeah, because this is such a rare kind of cross-group comparison survey, we try to highlight key similarities as well as, you know, kind of key discrepancies. And some of them may be a surprise to some of your listeners. For example, some of the key similarities that we find between Muslims and the general public and most subgroups within the general public is that the importance that they associate with being an American is just as high among Muslims as it is among any other subgroup in the general public and the general public at large. A somewhat more negative, perhaps, similarity is that Muslim women are no more likely to report gender discrimination than women in the general public. And so this kind of, you know, trope of Muslim women that they're always kind of abused or discriminated against within their community or by dint of being a Muslim woman, that doesn't seem to be a case. It just seems that, you know, unfortunately, women in general in America these days are, you know, at least reporting a high level of discrimination that they felt recently. Somewhat more surprising findings just generally too, though, are the degree to which the non-affiliated within the general public were on par with the opinions of American Muslims when it came to, you know, issues such as the Muslim travel ban or, you know, support for civil liberties, that kind of thing, and were actually more supportive of, you know, what we would expect to be normatively the Muslim opinion than Muslims themselves on a few issues. A large percentage of Muslims, 1 in 5, basically said that, you know, Muslims were more prone to violence. That's pretty much half when you ask that same question to the non-affiliated. So they are far less likely than Muslims themselves to say that Muslims are violent. And then, you know, one last thing that I'll mention is, during our launch program, David Dutwin, the methodologist that carried out these surveys, he remarked that, you know, one of the more linear findings you have in public opinion these days, if you, you know, you want to, you know, show an archetypal kind of linear relationship, just show, you know, age and religiosity, right? You know, and then the older you get, the more religious, and, you know, you're younger, you know, it's just a straight 45 degree angle, basically, right? We found that that wasn't the case among Muslims. The level of reported importance of religion in their lives is almost exactly equal among each age cohort within the American Muslim population. That bears perhaps a deeper investigation as to, you know, what that means and why that is, but it's just a neat finding nonetheless.
This administration has blatantly undermined public support for Muslims in this country. There's just no denying that. What kind of impact are these enormous changes in how our leaders address Islam having on the lives of American Muslims?
As you might expect, hate crimes are on the uptick noticeably, you know, generally within American society, but particularly toward American Muslims. We like to kind of note similarities and discrepancies among Muslims and the general public. One of the more notable discrepancies is that Muslims report experiencing the most religious discrimination among any major faith group that we surveyed. Making that connection, I think, between the rhetoric that we have in politics these days and the media these days and the lived reality of American Muslims, while we can't, you know, kind of make that direct connection just simply based on the evidence here. I think, you know, any kind of sober analysis and kind of good faith analysis will come to the conclusion that obviously, you know, the added discrimination that Muslims are facing these days has quite a bit to do with what's going on in the media landscape. One of the questions that we asked is whether or not they feel that the way that Muslims are portrayed in the media these days is harmful to American society generally. And you know, majorities almost across the board, with the slight exception of white evangelicals, agreed with that sentiment that this negative portrayal of Muslims is harmful to society. So clearly there is this notion that what is being said by elites is trickling down, you know, to the mass level and affecting Muslims in their everyday lives.
Yeah. Yusuf Shahood is co-author of the 2018 Institute for Social Policy and Understanding American Muslim Poll, Pride and Prejudice. The full survey is available online, and we'll link to it from stateofbelief.com. Yusuf, thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you so much. It was my absolute pleasure.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. Yet another big budget initiative to redefine our nation in the image of a very specific understanding of the Bible. We'll get details from researcher Fred Clarkson. And later, a new book from the Leadership Conference of Women Religious. However Long the Night, Making Meaning in a Time of Crisis. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Anyone who's been paying attention knows how effective the ALEC model for state-level legislating has been. Pro-business, anti-environment, the American Legislative Exchange Council has benefited greatly from support of the likes of the Koch brothers and has been devastatingly effective at enshrining their agenda and interest in laws in multiple states. Friends, this is not what democracy looks like. So then I guess why not apply this technique to pushing an ultra-conservative Christian fundamentalist culture war agenda? And if you're going to be tone-deaf as well as anti-democratic, why not call it Project Blitz? Well, let's ask writer and researcher Frederick Clarkson, who's just published a chilling report at Religion Dispatches headlined, Project Blitz Seeks to Do for Christian Nationalism What ALEC Does for Big Business. Fred, thanks for being with us again on State of Belief.
Well, thanks for having me. Sorry it has to be under these circumstances.
Fred, would you just start with a thumbnail sketch of what ALEC is and what it has achieved in our nation?
ALEC, as we say for short, is the, it's a coalition of business interests and state legislators. And ALEC produces model bills, and legislation that's introduced in different states is then compared, and they see what is successful and what isn't, and they learn along the way to maximize the clout of business interests on everything from taxes to the environment. And they've been tremendously effective in state legislatures all across the country.
So is Project Blitz overtly modeled on that scheme?
They don't say so, but in terms of their methodology, it sure looks like it. We wouldn't want to overdraw the comparison, but I think that it's fair. They do compare themselves a little bit to Americans United for Life, which produces model bills around abortion and euthanasia-related issues.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a little more complicated insofar as it's multiple organizations working on this, and then within a wider set of concentric circles of Christian right interest groups across the country.
So who are the key players behind this project?
Well, there are three main groups that are named in the documents. One is the Congressional Prayer Caucus Foundation, and another is the Wall Builders, headed by the Christian nationalist historian David Barton. He has his own state legislative network. And a third conservative Christian right legal outfit called the National Legal Foundation.
Fred, it is critically important that every single listener reads your report. Would you give us an overview of what Project Blitz is all about?
I think, like Alec, they have realized that lots of people are doing similar things around the country, and they might as well get on as close to the same page as they can. To do that, they will learn from legislative initiatives around the country and evolve their agenda over time. So what they've done here is they've looked around and they've put together 20 model bills. They're written generically because every state is so different. First around Christian nationalist themes in education, like posting In God We Trust in public buildings and the public schools. And a second category of proclamations and resolutions that governors and state legislatures can put out, commemorating, everything from the year of the Bible to Religious Freedom Day. And a third and very disturbing category that repackages in friendly language sort of the discrimination kinds of bills that we've been seeing around the country. Like there are two that in the news right now in Oklahoma, the state legislature has passed a bill that would allow adoption agencies to refuse service to LGBTQ couples mm-hmm. if they have a religious or moral objection. And a similar bill is going through the Kansas state legislature right now. Those bills are not exactly like these model bills and may have a different provenance, but they're the same idea as these bills, and it's a wealth of what the Christian right agenda is all about, and wealth and all framed under the rubric of religious liberty.
So would you say, as a generalization, that they are subverting democracy, or they are trying to bring about a Christian America?
I'd say that they are smartly using the tools of electoral democracy, representative democracy, in order to erode it and arguably to end it. When they talk about the adoption bill, for example, they're talking about implementing biblical values, quote-unquote, in public policy. Now, they'll dress it up in language about civil rights, but they really are. And the document that I write based on is very clear about wanting to move an agenda to promote biblical values and public policy. And that's a theocratic idea.
I'm assuming that in many of the state legislatures, this kind of thing is probably getting a warm welcome from far-right lawmakers.
Well, very much so. In 29 states, there are state legislative prayer caucuses, which sounds, innocent enough. But they're organized by the Congressional Prayer Caucus Foundation that has this particular agenda in mind. They're starting out with what they call soft bills, things that are going to generate less controversy. So in the first category, things like posting In God We Trust in the public schools, it's like, well, some people are going to oppose that for various reasons. But it tends to be a soft target. And so in Florida, for example, when that one passed, one of the main sponsors was a Democrat, and recently the Louisiana Senate passed one. And again, the sponsor was a Democrat, and it passed unanimously.
So, Fred, what do our listeners need to know most urgently about Project Blitz?
Well, Project Blitz is a maturation of the Christian right that many people think are dead or dying or discredited thanks to Donald Trump. But these folks are veterans. They're good at what they do, and they're learning from their successes and their mistakes over time. So to whatever extent you're concerned about the Christian right for whatever your issue area may be, this is a evolution. This is a new stage in evolution in political sophistication, organization, and strength on the Christian right to implement what they are calling religious liberty agenda in the states. It's at a relatively early stage, but their ambitions are great and very concerning.
Will they make an effort to bring other Christian right organizations together to work with them?
Oh, yeah, they're already doing that. This is an informal coalition. They call it a relational coalition. But they specifically, in their press conference announcing this, announced that they wanted to work with groups like the Heritage Foundation and the Family Policy Councils that are affiliated with Focus on the Family and the Family Research Council. So, yeah, it's not an initiative that's a standalone effort. They know who their coalition partners need to be, and I'm sure they're already working with them.
Tell me, as you write about this and as you speak about it, what scares you the most about what you're finding?
The erosion of democracy, and that all these things are happening in plain sight without any of us, until very recently me, not seeing it. These things are happening, and you know, you see the In God We Trust bills, and you see the adoption bills. But you see them as separate issues. So, we call them silos, issue silos. And everybody working in these issue silos is concerned about their thing, but they're not seeing how the groups promoting them see it as a part of a collective vision that they're seeking to achieve. And how one thing leads to another. And what we're not seeing, is the greatest danger.
So they're using democracy to kill democracy.
I think so.
Is there any kind of organized resistance that you're aware of to this anti-democratic project?
Well, again, everybody's doing their work in their areas, whether it's people working on to advance gay civil rights, to people fighting to preserve separation of church and state, like the Interfaith Alliance. But I think, again, what we're not seeing is that the nature of the opposition is different than what we're seeing in our individual issue areas.
But what are you seeing that is telling you these people are effective, they know what they're doing, and they're making progress with this anti-democratic message?
Well, in terms of Project Blitz specifically, they've only been in operation since 2015. They announced the formation, they started organizing the state prayer caucuses, and did their first legislative agenda in 2016. And they were pleased that a certain number of bills passed. They didn't even claim credit that they were all theirs. And then the second year, they improved their numbers greatly. And this year, when we took a look at what they had done so far, we can point to a couple of dozen bills that have been passed or are about to pass, and another 50 or 60 that are in the hopper at various stages in state legislatures. Some of them theirs, or others very similar in intent. So, like when we were saying earlier that their Christian right groups are cooperating at the state level, I think that would be a reflection. This body of the collected wisdom and intention and vision of Project Blitz is part of the conversation. So they're making progress. They're organizing state legislative caucuses. When they started out, they claimed 600 state legislators, for starters. They've increased their numbers every year. They've increased the number of bills introduced, the number of bills passed. So this, again, is an organization that represents a maturation of one of the historic political and religious movements in American history, and they're moving methodically and carefully, and they're showing considerable success.
Okay, Fred, worst case scenario. The organizers behind Project Blitz get their way. Describe the kind of America we would all be living in if their prayers come true.
Well, As a reporter, I risk speculating very far with that. But just in terms of their own stated intentions, I think we're looking at returning LGBTQ people to second-class citizens in terms of the justifications that they use in making these kinds of marginalizations. They're talking about people as being public health risks and inherently dysfunctional and a threat to children and society at large. Some of the rights of conscience bills are written so broadly that it could be returned to severe racial and religious discrimination in businesses that would be worse than the era we saw when racial discrimination was allowed in lunch counters in the 50s in America. So, yeah, we're talking about a rise of a certain kind of elite Christian sect in public life that determines the shape and direction of everyone else's lives.
Frederick Clarkson is a senior research analyst at Political Research Associates. He's the author of Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy, and editor of Dispatches from the Religious Left, The Future of Faith and Politics in America. Fred's vitally important new report, titled Project Blitz, seeks to do for Christian nationalism what Alec does for big business, is available at Religion Dispatches. We'll link to it from stateofbelief.com. Fred, thanks as always for being willing to talk with us here on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thanks again for having me. Your broadcast is vital to being able to talk about these things.
It was 2012, and we were scrambling to cover the stunning set of restrictions the Vatican had just imposed on Catholic women religious in this country. 6 years now have gone by, and in some ways the reasons the women religious were challenged in the first place, their focus on social and economic justice instead of just obsessing over abortion and LGBT matters, was a predictor of what Pope Francis, who was elected the following year, would focus on. But that's not to say things got easy. A new book based on this 6-year period, titled However Long the Night, Making Meaning in a Time of Crisis, the story of how an organization found an alternate contemplative way of working through impasse. So I am really happy to welcome one of the contributors, Sister Sharon Holland, to State of Belief Radio. Sister, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
For listeners who may not be familiar with what happened, would you just briefly summarize what it was that happened back in 2012, how it all began?
Well, of course, it began before 2012, but I will make an effort to be brief. In 2009, the presidents of the Leadership Conference of Women Religious were informed that the Vatican Office on Doctrine was going to conduct an assessment of our doctrinal stances. And then it was 3 years later when we received the results of that study of our doctrinal stances and so on in a document that was called Doctrinal Assessment and Mandate. And so the mandate set forth things that we needed to attend to.
Sister Allen, what was the immediate impact on the women religious among whom you were working at that time?
I think by and large, people were religious, as more and more found out about it, maybe shocked, hurt, angered, the range of emotions. I do need to say that this was geared to one conference of women religious and did not address the other group of religious. So it wasn't all of us, but it was most of us.
Yeah.
People were angry and sad and all of those things. feeling that it was not justified.
So the book focuses on resolving this seeming impasse in an alternate contemplative way. What does that mean?
Well, we needed ourselves some time to digest what had happened, even after it was resolved, to see more clearly what had happened and how it had happened. We had decided not to write a book that was a blow-by-blow of what went on, and we needed the time ourselves to examine our feelings and emotions and to look at the people involved. We had been working already as religious at becoming more contemplative. I would say that means listening with a quieter heart and mind, listening to the spirit, trying to look honestly at what we were experiencing, what was happening in lots of areas before this ever happened. And we definitely needed that deeper space of heart and listening to hear what the Spirit was saying to us and what was the right way to try to go forward in this. So the contemplative dimension preceding talking, acting, responding, reacting was extremely important. I remember one of the big meetings early on in this when I was so aware that the Holy Spirit was in this big ballroom where we were and that people had entered into quiet and were listening, and it was our decision then to go forward with integrity in seeing what was going to happen.
Sister Holland, I am assuming that being contemplative is not antithetical to also continuing with the kind of social conscience and social ministries you did.
Oh, no, it's not contrary to it. I think it's essential to it, to have a right conscience and a right action discerning in some of the awful situations that we have to deal with today in our country, in our world, require the contemplative, and it's part of a movement into action.
Mm-hmm.
One of our sisters who's been in all sorts of protests against arms and militarism and so on and has spent time in jail is one of the most contemplative people I know.
Hmm.
That precedes the action.
How did this direction end up being the one that LCWR took? I mean, I'm sure there must have been disagreement as to how best to respond.
Well, there was, and that as a conference and as individual conferences and congregations and religious, we'd been working on learning how to enter into things in a more prayerful, contemplative way and not just reacting to things. Mm-hmm. So we'd been working on that, and you're right, there were all kinds of reactions. That's why that scene in the ballroom sticks in my mind, because there were 800 or 900 of us there who were deciding whether and how to go forward with this,
mm-hmm.
and various opinions, and people who wanted to just say forget it, and other people who wanted to say no, we need to follow through on this.
Mm-hmm.
And the presence of the Spirit was palpable.
Hmm. Your chapter in the book is titled The Power of Secrecy and Perceptions. Please talk about that power, if you would.
One of the most important things to me that happened in the process of dealing with the bishop delegates and with the representatives of the office called Doctrine of the Faith was in a meeting late in the process when we'd made a lot of progress already in mutual respect and understanding. And one of the officials said he regretted that perceptions had become institutionalized.
Mm.
And to me, that broke open an understanding of some of what was going on and of what could be a key to making progress in some of the things in our country that's divided and in our world that's divided. Perceptions had become institutionalized. Opinions about us hadn't been reexamined since somebody gave that opinion way back sometime. So some of the things that we were accused of, if they'd ever been true, hadn't been true for years. And we were perceived as going too far with Vatican II, not having sufficient respect for authority of the church, various things, and nobody had reexamined them lately. That's what it said to me. And, you know, isn't that what's happening with some of our issues of racism, of people in general, of even the Koreas now, you know, all of the, there's so many places in the world that, how do we think about those people and what do we really know?
Because we're seeing an unprecedented level of polarization in our society right now, this is a book that this nation can learn from, don't you think?
I do. For people who want to go about solving things in a different way than just arguing back and forth and pointing out what's wrong with each other, I think it has a lot to offer. I have to say, in all honesty, even though we had different opinions on things, we were dealing with wonderful people who really had the same deep values of love for the church and respect for religious life, who maybe didn't think we were doing it right, but were willing to listen to us and find out how we were going about things. So I think there's a wisdom in it that could help anyone who wants to go about things differently, but some things that are dividing our country and our world are much bigger than what divided us.
Right.
We had wonderful bishops to work with, and but yes, I mean, we have to build relationships. That's one of the things that we saw was happening as we met over the 3 years. We were building relationships and trust, and then we shared more, and then we respected each other more.
How can we reduce the impact specifically of secrecy and perceptions on the disagreements that we are enduring in our nation right now?
I don't know what we do with secrecy. You know, it gets cloaked as confidentiality, and sometimes that's essential. And sometimes it's just, like, in our case, we felt like we never knew really where this came from and how it got started. And in the end, in a way, that doesn't matter, but it leaves you suspicious, and then you make speculations. The working on relationships with people so that you can listen to each other helps break down perceptions. If a person is willing, if you get to know somebody, if you have a relationship with somebody, sometimes it's very small things. But I know I was teaching an international group of students part of the time, and after I came to know somebody from a certain country, I was more interested in that country. It wasn't just an anonymous thing anymore. So that's a very small example, but I guess I go back to the willingness to listen and to build a relationship so that someone else is open. It's a little hard to pin down how it happens.
You know, I have already said during our discussion that I think the audience for this book should be much larger than one might think from its cover and its title. Tell us, for people who pick up this book, what do you want them most? What do you most want them to see and feel and think after they read this book?
I guess I would want them to believe that there's another way to go about resolving things than the contentious. I'm very conscious that we were dealing with people of faith, and I certainly think that makes a huge difference. I'm not saying which faith, but people of faith who believe that God travels with us. This thing, however long the night, is from an African proverb of some sort, and you know it continues. The day comes, the dawn comes. Mm-hmm. God is faithful to us throughout the whole night.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, having faith, really learning to listen to other people. I don't know how you make it happen in politics, but if people are changed inside, gradually, they can do something. You all with the Alliance, with the various organizations, every time another person is in this line of relationship building for the common good, we can move it forward another little bit.
Sister Sharon Holland is Vice President of the Servants of the Immaculate Heart of Mary Sisters in Monroe, Michigan. A canon lawyer, she has taught at Catholic University, spent 20 years in Rome, and holds a doctorate in canon law. Sister Sharon contributed to the new book, However Long the Night, Making Meaning in a Time of Crisis, the story of how an organization found an alternate contemplative way of working through impasse. Sister Sharon, I want to thank you so much for being a part of this book, for publishing the book, and also for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. It's been good to be with you.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you think there's value in the conversations we present and the voices we amplify in the midst of the gridlock our public rhetoric too often becomes, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.